Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto on Friday, May the 20th. Absolutely beautiful day here in the Dallas area. We're going to be starting today a series of programs about World War II. You may remember that we had programs about World War I all of last year. Well, we're going to be looking at World War II with our good friend Barry Jacobson. Barry, of course, a military historian and blogger as well, and we have a link to his website on the show information. We're going to look at what was happening in Europe. In order to understand World War II, obviously you have to understand the first one that ended in 1918. A lot of things began to happen in different countries, and we're going to look at some of that tonight. We're going to see what happened in Germany, what happened in what was called Russia during the first war, and then became, of course, the Soviet Union after the collapse of the Tsars. We're going to look at Mussolini. We're going to look at the United States as well. The United States went into a period of isolation that to some degree contributed to the fact that this war went on for so long without the American people being involved. So let me say hello to my good friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. How are you?
Absolutely great. Beautiful day here in the Dallas area. We're going to, you know, we had a lot of fun doing our first series on World War I. And tonight we're going to go into World War II. And I think, Barry, in order to understand the second war that we're going to cover, you sort of have to understand how the first one ended. And the first one ended, of course, with a victory of sorts, but at the same time with a lot of unresolved issues. And we're going to deal tonight with some of those consequences for communism, fascism. So you do you agree with me that in order to understand the Second War, you have to sort of understand how the first one ended, Barry?
No, I think that's correct. And in fact, I think we decided to title this first installment as Out of the Ashes, because the roots of World War II rise out of the ashes of World War I. It was a ghastly war. It brought about the total social destruction of the old regime, the ancient regime of Europe. The listeners have to understand that before World War I, Europe was not simply a minor, you know, peninsula or continent extending from the rest of the Eurasian landmass. It was the heart of, really, the beating heart of world civilization. The European powers had conquered most of the world. The so-called great powers, the empires of Britain, Austro-Hungary, Germany, Russia, and the Republic of France, and even little tiny Belgium controlled large swaths of the world. And it was sort of a family concern. And a lot of these royal families were related by blood. Many were related to Queen Victoria, in fact, of England. Tsar Nicholas of Russia, the last Tsar of Russia, looks like a twin brother of the king of England, King George V. So, these are all cousins fighting. And World War I destroyed it all. It brought about the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was dissolved after the war. It brought about the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, which had existed since the 13th century in one form or another. It brought about the fall of the Tsar of Russia and the rise of communism, which we'll talk about in just a minute. In Italy, fascism soon took over. The only two countries that remained more or less politically stable after the war were England and France. Germany collapsed from Kaiser Wilhelm, who was the emperor of Germany. He abdicated at the end of the war, and Germany just fell into chaos. So, and so also important to remember the death toll. I mean, it was a ghastly war politically, but just in the butcher's bill alone, it was some 38 million people died in that war in one form or other, either civilian or military casualties.
Yeah.
So this left Europe, in complete disorder and ready for something new, and that new was what rose out of the ashes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting observation, because sometimes these movements, whether it's communism, fascism, whatever, they sometimes exploit economic difficulties to come to power, and there's no doubt that if you look at the world of the 1920s, the United States retrenched, and the 20s were actually a very good economic period for the United States, whatever they were called, the Roaring 20s or whatever. But that was not the case, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was not the case in some of the important countries of Europe. Germany, the economy collapsed during that time, or it never maybe got off the ground. Russia, now the USSR, still had huge problems. So I would think that when you combine this political instability with some very bad times economically, that what you get is somebody like a Hitler, promising to, I don't want people to say I'm talking about Trump, but I mean saying something like, let's make Germany great again type of thing, which is somewhat what they were promising, of course, the Soviets in Russia. So I think the economy, Barry, had a lot to do with these two things that you're going to tell us about in a minute, communism and fascism, Barry.
No, I think you're absolutely right. That's a great point. You got to think of these things, all these social revolutions, as sort of opportunistic infections on the body politic. Just like when your body is healthy, it can fight off minor infections with relative ease. When your body is compromised, when your immune system is compromised, then you don't have the ability to do that. And the economy, when the economy is weak, and when people can't find jobs, and when there's social chaos, it just invites these movements to rise up and take advantage of the situation. And that's exactly what happened in much of Europe throughout the 1920s and into the early 1930s, leading to the rise of these various movements.
That's right. And one of the things that we cannot relate to, because we've had, the United States, or in, people of our age group, we have lived in relative prosperity. There have been some tough recessions, I know. But to live in a country, excuse me, where the currency is worthless, where you had to fill a little carriage or whatever of bills because the money was worthless. They would change the price 3 or 4 times a day because the money was worthless. That is the kind of experience that makes people very desperate, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous photograph from the 1920s during the early days of the Weimar Republic in Germany. That's the Democratic Republic that replaced the rule of the Kaiser after the fall of the Kaiser and the end of World War I. But there's a famous photograph of a fellow going to the grocery market to pick up food, and he's got Deutschmarks, the German currency, in literally filling the wheelbarrow with stacks of bills just to buy a loaf of bread. Just astonishing. And, that wasn't just the only thing that was going on. Keep in mind, if we can start with Germany for a minute, let me start, with the end of World War One. In 1918, Germany began, and in fact, Germany and the Central Powers, Austria, Ottoman Turkey, and Germany were the so-called Central Powers. They began the year very strong. And in fact, Russia had collapsed into revolution in 1917 when the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin, took over and withdrew from war. And that released a tremendous amount of troops from the Eastern Front, German Eastern Front, which had been in Poland and in East Prussia, to then move to the Western Front. And it looked very much for a time there that Germany might win the war. And that was the early spring. They had a massive offensive called the Ludendorff Offensive, named after Erich von Ludendorff, who we'll talk about in a minute, as it relates to Nazism. And then everything went bad for them. Everything just went south. The United States entered the war. American troops arrived just in the nick of time. Were able to stop the breakthroughs that the Germans were achieving. And by November, the war ended with an armistice and Germany collapsing. And a lot of German soldiers and Germans back home wondered what the heck just happened. You know, we were winning, and it was the ninth inning, and we were up by 5 runs, and suddenly, you know, we throw in the towel. And they looked for someone to blame. And it became fertile ground that a myth grew up that Germany had been betrayed from within by enemies. And these enemies were the communists or socialists who had positions in parliament, and by the Jews, who controlled a lot of the banking and a lot of the labor unions, who had gone on strike towards the end of the war and shut down Germany's economy. So Germans were looking for a scapegoat, and Hitler comes along with the Nazi Party in the 1920s. Hitler, by the way, is a World War I veteran himself, and he uses this veteran status and the fact he is wounded by mustard gas and spent the last year of the war convalescing in a hospital to make himself some sort of a martyr and a national hero. And he aligns himself with this new movement called the Nazi Party, which is the German National Socialist Workers' Party. It was a breakoff of the Socialist Party. We often think of Nazis
Barry,
as a right-wing
movement.
Barry,
one quick question. Let me ask you, forgive me for interrupting you, but I just want to, the word Nazi comes from what? N-A-Z-I. Where does that come from? Is that National
Nazi
Socialist?
Yeah, National Socialist Workers' Party, NSDAP,
okay,
was the actual name of the party. It was shortened by the English-speaking world to Nazi. But the Germans didn't call themselves Nazis. They call themselves National Socialists.
Okay.
It was just the Western press that dubbed them Nazis.
Okay, good. I'm glad you explained that because I didn't know that. Thanks.
Yeah, and they were actually an offshoot of the DAP, the DAP, the German Workers' Party, Deutsche Workers' Party, and it evolved eventually into the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party, under leadership of, by 1921, by Adolf Hitler. This returned veteran was an inspired orator. He was a failed artist. He tried to be an artist early in his life, and he eventually joined, you know, the war as a soldier, rose the rank of corporal. And to give him credit, he actually was a decorated soldier. But he was a gifted orator. He was able to inspire with the spoken word in a way that has seldom been seen before or since. He started off slow and quiet and almost shy, reserved, and build to a grand crescendo by the end of his speeches. We often think of Hitler as screaming, but that's far from the truth. When you listen to his speeches, or even listen to him on the one tape where he's actually just talking in a conversation, he's a very soft-spoken man. And by starting off soft, his audience would get drawn in, listening, you know, closer because it was hard to hear him. And as the passion rose in his voice, he would just catch them in this whirlwind of oratory. He was aided in his rise to power by the so-called Free Corps, which were returning veterans forming these paramilitary units called Free Corps, who in 1919 were battling in the streets with the communists. In 1919, in January, there was an uprising by the communists in Germany called the Spartacus Uprising. And this led a lot of Germans to think that they were in real danger of happening what happened in Russia with the rise of the Bolsheviks and the overthrow of the government. So Hitler took advantage of that also later on to expand his hold on the Germans. Let me step, if we can for a second, Sylvia, can we step away and talk about the Bolsheviks for just a minute?
Yeah, no, go ahead. But I wanted to just say one quick thing, Barry, because it's amazing when you're talking about Hitler. I just want to say one very quick thing, just a second. If I had taken Hitler out of a crowd and brought him to you and said, this man is going to inspire these millions of people, he was not a very impressive guy physically or anything like that. I mean, he was in many ways very plain-looking because of the injuries in the war. I mean, he was not an impressive guy to talk to or look at. So he had some magic, or maybe it wasn't so much his magic as the desperation of the masses. Maybe a perfect storm there, Barry. I just wanted to get that in.
Well, I mean, Bernie Sanders is not a very inspiring figure, and Donald Trump has bad hair. So I think when it comes to politics, the physical is probably the least important thing, oddly enough. It's the way a person speaks that probably is the most important thing when it comes to politics. The ability to articulate a message that finds resonance among the masses, the ability to sell yourself as sincere in that message, and the ability to speak and articulate the thoughts, the wishes, the secret dreams of the audience. And Hitler was able to do that in a way that very few before or after have.
That's right.
Later on in our series, we'll talk more about the philosophy of the Nazis and so on. But suffice to say that Hitler was a spellbinding orator.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing.
Well, let's go to the Bolsheviks. You wanted to make a detour to the Bolsheviks.
Actually, before we get there, let's talk about Mussolini, the other fascist movement, and actually the most successful during the 1920s. Mussolini was a socialist writer starting in 1912, and he rose to prominence and became a leading figure in the Italian socialist movement. He broke with the Socialist Party over World War I in 1914. He believed that World War I should be supported by socialism as a way of overthrowing the monarchies. Who were, in those days, the real enemy, the ancient regime. He clearly saw that what was to come. He predicted the fall of the Tsar, for instance. So, he broke with the socialists who wanted to basically boycott the war as a bourgeois war that would do nothing but aggrandize the various royal families and their ambitions. He formed eventually the Fascist Party, and the real difference between the Fascist Party and the socialists that it came from was that it was a nationalist party. Socialists believed in those days in an international workers' brotherhood in which all the workers of the world would unite eventually and overthrow the existing governments. And there'd be one world government. Hitler and Mussolini, who were also socialists early in their life to some extent or another, believed in nationalism and with socialist political and economic leanings. But they didn't believe in the breakdown of the nation state. They were very much nationalists. They believed in the destiny of Germany and the destiny of Italy. Now, Mussolini, in 1923, had a so-called March on Rome. His black-shirted fascisti marched en masse on Rome and took over the capital. And he was quickly elected prime minister, a democratic rank that he held until 1925, when eventually he turned it into a dictatorship. But he was originally elected, just like Hitler would be in the 1930s, he was elected democratically. And Hitler saw that and thought, well, this is the way to go. So later that year, 1923, Hitler had the so-called Beer Hall Putsch, in which he tried to overthrow the government of Bavaria by his Nazis taking to the streets and forming barricades and fighting the police. And it failed. And he was himself arrested and went to prison for a couple years. And then it was in prison that he wrote his book, Mein Kampf, which means my struggle, in which he articulated the destiny of Germany as he saw it. And this found great resonance because it talked of Germany finding its place as the greatest power in the world again. It had been a great power once. It'll be the greatest under Hitler, or so they said. And to do this, they had to conquer a living space in the East. They basically had to conquer the Untermensch, the subhumans, as they called them, Slavic peoples to the east, which meant Poland and Russia. This would have a huge influence on the way the war would be conducted in later years. So that's Hitler and Mussolini rising to power in the 20s, and Hitler, by the end of the 1920s, was out of prison, and the Nazi Party was back into electoral politics and was actually being very successful.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be until 1930s they actually returned to power.
I was going to say something about Mussolini. I have seen newsreels of Mussolini. I don't think I've ever heard him. I don't believe I've heard his voice, but I think I've seen newsreels. And, I mean, he was a pretty good-looking guy, very passionate. I can see why he would create that kind of following, with the Italian people. But was it also, just one more question about Mussolini, was it also because of the economy? I mean, was the Italian economy also in bad shape like the others' economy were?
Well, keep in mind that all the European powers were experiencing economic difficulties in the 1920s, leading into the 1930s, but nothing like Germany. He was able to articulate a vision of a return of the Roman Empire under the fascists, that Italy would find its place in the sun by expanding its colonial empire, which at that time only existed in North Africa. The colonial empire of Italy, and like most of the great powers, was fairly limited. It was limited to basically Libya. And he wanted to expand it and create a new Roman Empire, which would include Greece, the Eastern and Central Mediterranean, He envisioned eventually pushing the British out of Egypt. And in fact, in the 1930s, he invaded Ethiopia from the Italian colony of Eritrea near Somalia. He invaded Ethiopia and conquered the country, which, by the way, was we'll talk about when we talk next week about the League of Nations. One of the things that brought about the downfall of the League of Nations, they did nothing to stop that. They allowed that aggression to go forward.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so can we talk about the Bolsheviks real quick?
Sure, go ahead.
So at the end of World War One, there's a democratic government in Russia. The Tsar collapses and abdicates, goes into exile in Siberia. And that lasts for less than a year before the Bolsheviks, who are part of the government, stage another revolution. The first was in February 1917. In October 1917, Red October occurs, and the Bolsheviks take over. And that leads to a civil war between the so-called whites, the non-communists, and the Reds. That goes on until 1923, and it ends with the complete victory of Lenin and Trotsky and the communists. And what they envision is a world communist government that will eventually, along with, as all socialists believe, eventually create a one-world state in which the workers will have united and formed a workers' paradise. Trotsky deviated with his counterparts, and Trotsky really believed that, whereas Lenin used the Soviet Union as a power base and wanted to expand it as sort of a new empire, and Stalin carried on those policies with a vengeance. Trotsky eventually was exiled by Stalin after Lenin died for that very reason. He didn't see it as a nationalist movement in Russia and the surrounding area, but saw it instead as a true workers' paradise. It was a workers' revolution. And so he went into exile. But in the 1920s, the Bolsheviks have taken over Russia, and they invade Poland. And Poland is one of these nations that was created out of the Russian Empire at the end of World War One by the Treaty of Versailles and by negotiations that followed. Poland had not been an independent nation since the 19th century, and then only briefly in the 19th century. It had been part of Russia and part of Germany. So the parts that belonged to Germany were taken away and given to back to this new nation of Poland, and the parts that had been Russian Poland became, you know, independent. So both the Russians and the Germans had a joint cause to want to see Poland carved back up again, because Poland had been, before World War One, again, part of either of those two nations. So Russia, under the Red Army under Trotsky, invades Poland in the 1920s, and they're soundly defeated. The Poles make use of the first air force and to have a real tactical ground attack mode in modern history. And using airplanes, they rout they succeed in routing the Russian army, Red Army. But that's just the beginning, as both those powers, the communists and the fascists, look to Poland as something that needs to be divided up.
Yeah. Talking about these different movements and coming out of the poverty and all of that, or the economic troubles. And we'll get into more specific, of course, as our series goes. We'll devote, you know, entire shows to many of these important characters of that period. But I was thinking about one thing. After World War II, one of the biggest objectives of President Truman was the creation of what came to be known as the Marshall Plan. And to what extent was that influenced, the Marshall Plan was influenced, and by the way, we should say that President Truman was also a soldier in World War One, and then the commander-in-chief for certainly the last year of the war. But to what extent was that Marshall Plan a consequence of having seen what happened after the First War, when people were basically left in misery, and in that misery they turned to these radical movements, Barry?
Well, it was a great influence, as was the United Nations. What Truman and before him Roosevelt did not want to see happen is what happened at the end of World War I, which is that Woodrow Wilson tried to form the League of Nations. He sold it to Europe, this organization that would put an end to war. It'd be a league of where the nations could come to conference. In this case, it was in Geneva. That's where the league headquarters was. And they would discuss their differences, and they would arbitrate. And in cases where there would be a military aggressor, they would intervene. Be joint action. And the problem was the United States didn't join it. Woodrow Wilson couldn't sell it to the American Congress. We were still living in an age where America felt that it should keep apart from affairs of Europe, as George Washington warned us way back when. And there just was no stomach for being involved with European affairs. We were very reluctantly drawn into World War I in the first place. So we didn't join, and there was no plan to bail out, and I'm not sure we could have in those days. We weren't the superpower that we became later on, though we were a wealthy country by 1919. But in any case, we didn't bail out Europe, and Europe fell into economic chaos, at least the defeated powers were. And these defeated powers, Germany in particular, had a grievance. You know, the Treaty of Versailles was punitive. It punished Germany. It punished Italy. I'm sorry, Austria. It punished them for starting war, the war that really had been started as a domino effect that they had no control over. Germany had not been the aggressor at the start of World War I. That war, as we talked about in our last series, was a series of events that lit a powder keg that existed because of these interlocking treaties that all the European powers had to come to each other's defense. And once the dominoes started to fall, there was nothing the Kaiser or the Austro-Hungarian Emperor or the Ottoman Sultan could do to stop it, or the Tsar of Russia, for that matter.
Right. So Germany in the early 19... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just kidding. Germany felt aggrieved. It felt like it had been blamed for the war.
Sure.
They had to pay crippling war reparations to France.
Mm-hmm.
France invaded Germany in the 1920s when Germany was unable to pay their debt, and it took over the Ruhr section, the industrial section of Germany, about the same time that Hitler came to power as the leader of the Nazi Party and began the beer hall push against the government. So
right.
There were a lot of factors that led to the rise of Hitler, but a big part of it was the fact that after World War I, the United States had not stayed active and moderated the punitive actions against Germany.
Right. So, you know, a little nation building back then, although you're right, it would have been difficult with our resources, but there was no stomach. I think you explained it correctly. There was no stomach in the American people for doing any of this. They just, you know, they just wanted to get out, come over here, have a good time, which they did in the 1920s. And again, I'm not necessarily blaming people for feeling that way. They weren't, you know, a lot of Americans maybe felt disenchanted about World War I, and their reaction was to stay away. So let's finish today's first episode by setting it up this way for the next episode. It's 1933, March 1933. President Roosevelt is inaugurated on primarily a bad economy in the United States, what we now call the Great Depression. So as Roosevelt is inaugurated and raises his right hand to accept the presidency, who was in power in March of 1933 in Europe, let's say in Germany? Was it already Hitler?
Well, first of all, in Europe, the Mussolini had been in power for almost 10 years at that point.
Okay.
Just prime minister, first as prime minister, and then later as El Duce, the leader, in 1925. In January 1933, Paul von Hindenburg is elected president of Germany with Hitler as his chancellor. Hindenburg doesn't live very long. He only lives until 1934, and he dies. So a year later, Hitler finds himself the sole power in Germany. And by the way, he very quickly that year consolidates power by passing laws that give him basically dictatorial emergency powers that he never relinquishes thereafter. France had a republic. It was a weak republic, led by foolish men. Britain was still, in theory, the British Empire, with the prime minister in charge and the king. Of course, King George the Fifth, who had been king during World War I, had died and been replaced by Edward VIII, who would soon abdicate in a scandalous fashion after having an affair with an American heiress, American divorcee, and would be replaced by his brother, King George the Sixth. Russia was ruled by Lenin, of course, until mid-1920s, and he was replaced late 1920s and replaced by Stalin, who consolidated powers in the late 1920s and eliminated all of his rivals, particularly Trotsky, and made himself dictator of Russia or the Soviet Union. So those are the powers that are in place in 1933 for the most part. Spain has yet to go through a civil war. We'll talk about that in another installment. Spain is still a monarchy and a republic.
Right. And then, of course, we haven't even gotten to Japan. We're going to get to that later on because that eventually was a huge factor, too, in the war. But give us a tip of where we will go the next time, Barry. Today we talked about communism, fascism, and how that came into being in Europe. Give us a sense of where we will go the next time.
Well, we've already talked. We were going to talk about more about the emergence of the leaders, but in fact, we blended that into this one. So I think the next episode will be the failure of appeasement in the outbreak of war. In 1930s, there's an effort to appease Hitler as he makes one or more demands. And that feeding of the wolf by giving him what he wants was supposed to calm him and give him and settle things down. And it had just the opposite effect. Emboldened them to keep asking for more until eventually the allies, the Western powers, were painted into a corner and forced to fight. If they had tried to back Hitler down earlier without appeasing him, they may have prevented war, but in fact, just the opposite was done. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the rise of fascism in Japan as well. Mm-hmm. Japan is going through a transformation where the military is taking over the civilian government and pushing to create a new empire throughout the Pacific that will push the United States out of the Pacific and replace it with a Japanese empire that will rule that region.
Right. Always remember the great words of Winston Churchill, something about the crocodile, the guy who thinks that if he feeds the crocodile, he won't eat him or something like that. It's a great phrase. I can't quite think of what it was, but I saw a great cartoon one time that if you feed the crocodile, he'll eat you last or something like that, or he'll leave you alone. And I think that's what the 1930s and the appeasement was all about, Barry. Do you recall that phrase?
I don't, but before next episode, I will be able to quote it verbatim.
It's one of the great lines of appeasement, I think, ever spoken. And, of course, when you speak about Winston Churchill, and we'll get into him as well in one of the future episodes. But next time, we'll talk a little bit about all of this, and we're going to do a bunch of these shows. And if the next, however, are as great as tonight, we're going to have a lot of fun, Barry.
It's going to be a wild time, and hopefully we'll conclude this by September in time for when the war actually ended, which was of 1945.
If we have to double up on some shows and catch up with the calendar, we definitely will. But I want to thank you again. You're such an impressive military historian, just so knowledgeable about all of these things. And I'm already looking forward to our next one, Barry. Thank you so much.
You take care, and I'm looking forward to it as well. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back with a closing thought. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. This is going to be a great series. I'm looking forward to it already with our friend Barry Jacobson. Now, if you want to read about World War II, and there's lots of books, one of the ones that I like the most is Winston Churchill wrote a series of books about World War II. But if you want to read about it, but you don't have time, you're busy or whatever, check out our friends at audible.com. We have a link to their website. If you click on that, it'll take you to their website. And just do a little search about World War II, and I think you'll find lots and lots of good audiobooks about that period of time. The great thing about Audible.com, one of the things I love about it, is that if you go in there, you're going to find something, because they have so many great sales and they have so much inventory that you're very likely to find something when you go into Audible.com. So check it out, and maybe get yourself a good audiobook about World War II so you can follow us on this amazing series. My thanks to Barry Jacobson. We have a link to his website on the show information. He writes a great military history blog. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Thank you. And we'll see you the next time when we continue this amazing story about World War II. Goodbye, everybody.